firsthand. It is completely fake news. And as you said, people can just surf the internet and see what Tehran and other cities in Iran look like.
Yeah, I've been there twice too. And in the north of Tehran, women are wearing hats instead of, and nobody's, you know, impounding them. Police is right there and nothing's going on. So you don't even need to really ask people. Just do a little bit of research on your own outside of these obviously biased sources.
Definitely.
So lastly, the foreign policy piece claims that Iran is regularly ranked as one of the worst countries to be a woman in terms of gender parity for economic opportunities, education, health concerns, and political leadership. Guess according to whom, Marwa? According to research by the World Bank and the World Economic Forum, WEF. So that was coming from an American news publication, the same America that does not only suppress women, but now has given the right for men to identify as women while knowing fully well that education and health care are completely free for all Iranian citizens, unlike the USA, where they wrote these dishonest lines about Iranian woman.
Wow. I mean, the audacity, especially of these organizations who continue to control many sovereign states but have never been able to control the Iranian state, for that matter, claim that all these fake news about Iran just to play with words and brainwash the public. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and they want to begin with their current control of Iran by controlling women, which they haven't been able to do.
Despite the fact that women in Iran have their rights met years ago, some rights that are not even found in the West. But I want to thank you very much, our mainstream media expert in this segment, Ms. Julia Qasim, for joining us to talk about this pressing matter that we always see whenever there's something happening in Iran, especially if it's elections. Thank you for your contribution,
dear Julia.
And now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. Another topic that was center stage last week, especially on social media platforms, was the airdrop charade of aid and expired food on Gaza residents and the famine caused by the ongoing Zionist-Israeli genocide. Here is Sima Itaim, our social media expert and editor at The Cradle, with more.
Thank you, Marwa. So airdropping aid, much like a placebo, it might make people feel better if they're watching, people who are watching from afar. But at the end of the day, it's a showy PR exercise and it's inadequate. It's pathetically inadequate.
I hear you.
It's useless to the point where it becomes a metaphor and not more for the abject failure of the international community to muster up any kind of meaningful response to such an immense, unprecedented humanitarian tragedy.
I second that. Definitely.
So for the first post, we have a post by Big Brother 7 who criticizes these airdrops, saying, reports from Gaza say the airdrops of today weren't enough for 100 people. For reference, there are hundreds of thousands of starving people in northern Gaza, with many children already dying due to hunger. The airdrops are just a cruel charade at this point.
I second his opinion. I mean, people who see my Twitter can see that I was very vocal about this, so I'm not going to stop you anymore.
Right. We knew. I mean, we could tell from the beginning. And then the aid killed some civilians.
Yes, exactly.
So it got even worse than what we had expected. For the second post, we have by Quds News Network that quotes the Gaza government media office reporting that the situation of famine is deteriorating, with 2.4 million people experiencing severe food shortages and airdrops, which have proven to be futile.
Oh, my God.
So along with this post, Quds News Network attaches a photo with a quotation from the Gaza government media office saying that dropping aid from the air and avoiding its entry through the crossings circumvents the root solutions to the problem.
Definitely. I mean, the border is there. Open the border, for the love of God.
Where there are thousands of trucks, not just hundreds, waiting to be let through. We have another post by Asaf, MD, on X, saying that not only is the amount of aid being airdropped completely insufficient, the most vulnerable of Gaza's civilian population will be unable to access the aid. So he attached a video where a care representative in Ramallah tells Sky News that these airdrops make it impossible for people with disabilities to remain alive.
First of all, there is the issue of accuracy, there is the issue of being so expensive, the limited number that they will have, and the limited content. So it's only meals, while the needs are massive. And most importantly, you only those who can reach physically strong to reach to these aid will be getting them. So women, elderly, women-headed household, people with, unfortunately, disabilities will not be among those that are going to access the aid.
So even people with disabilities are finding it hard to get the least amount of aid in Gaza.
Yeah, the minimum. We have another post on X from a Gaza resident who is currently displaced, to southern Gaza with his family, Maysara at whatever 2067, laying it out as it is. Jordan complicity turns Gaza into a hunger game where people have to fight and even get killed to get food. Israel wanted this, and Jordan airdrops did the job.
Sadly said by a Gazan who is a resident of Gaza displaced to Rafah. And I think the people that we should hear the most are the Palestinian people in Gaza and no one else outside that besieged area. Mm-hmm.
So now in response to the World Health Organization's report entitled Gaza Worst Famine Fears Realized as 10th Child Reportedly Starves to Death, mm-hmm. Michael Fakhri, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, posted, Israel has been intentionally starving the Palestinian people in Gaza since October 8. Now famine may very well be already occurring. The only way to end, prevent this famine is an immediate ceasefire. And the only way to get a ceasefire is to sanction Israel. Wow. So that was a first, mm-hmm. I think, Marwa. We see a UN rapporteur calling for sanctioning the Israeli entity. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've seen that before. Mm-hmm. In order to reach a ceasefire, this is kind of coming to terms with reality, finally realizing that there is no other way around this.
Definitely. Even we were listening a bit from the Biden administration, certain officials saying that they don't condone what's happening, yet they don't have the power to change it, which we really don't believe. But listening to this, having this voice out in the open, especially on social media, is something unprecedented indeed, and all for the sake of Palestinians in Gaza. Thank you very much, Seema, for
Thank
your
you,
contribution
Mara.
And telling us what happened on X, especially on X this time, because it was a very heated discussion concerning whether aid was actually helping the Palestinians or not. Thank you for being here and for your analysis. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to Figures Exposé. The overwhelming majority of civilians in Gaza are dependent on direct assistance from the UNRWA agency, which is also a critical lifeline for other aid organizations working inside Gaza that rely on its aid infrastructure to distribute support. However, a recent opinion poll shows that the majority of the Israeli entity settlers oppose the transfer of humanitarian aid to Palestinian people in the besieged Gaza Strip, where the occupying regime has been waging a genocidal war since October 2023. The findings were published in a survey conducted by the so-called Israel Democracy Institute, saying over two out of the three Jewish Israeli settlers, which accounted for 68% of respondents, disapprove of the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, while a large 85% majority of Arab respondents in occupied Palestine supported. Now, when asked, do you support or oppose the idea that Zionist Israel should allow the transfer of humanitarian aid to Gaza residents at this time, with food and medicine being transferred by international bodies that are not linked to Hamas or to the UNRWA, Arab respondents gave an 85% approval to 13% disapproval rate. Left Jews gave a 59% approval to 39% approval rate. Disapproval rate. Now, center Jews gave a 44% approval to 51.5% disapproval rate. And right-wing Jews gave a 19% approval to a swooping 80% disapproval rate. Now, the results of the Israeli entity survey came as the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, said in a recent report that 550,000 people in Gaza are currently facing catastrophic food insecurity levels. Now, let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. Imagine you are at home with your wife and children. It's dinner time before you put your three children to sleep. The room is cold, the propane cooking cylinder is empty, and there is no food, no electricity, and no drinking water. This is Gaza. Gaza is starving. Starvation in Gaza is not due to a drought or natural disaster, but it is rather an Israeli entity-made catastrophe enabled by the U.S. Biden administration. Rana Umeish on Instagram shared a video by a Palestinian displaced resident of Gaza who wept while telling us about the last meal he had. For famine to be declared, at least 20% of the population must be suffering extreme food shortages, with 1 in 3 children acutely malnourished and 2 people out of every 10,000 dying daily from starvation or from malnutrition and disease. But in late December, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, IPC, said that the situation in Gaza has already exceeded the 20% threshold. Now, as the United States airdropped aid into the Gaza Strip, its parachutes, like those of the other participating countries, brought only a tiny fraction of the aid needed for the 2.2 million Palestinians trapped without food, water, or medical supplies. However, never in a million years would have anyone thought that the U.S. dropped food aid would be expired food. Yes, you heard that right. Let's hear Bobby's voice on TikTok.
38,000 expired meals. The Biden administration just dropped 38,000 expired meals into Gaza. I quite literally don't even know what to say about this. Like, to be that vile and foul of a human being, if you can even call yourself that, to send people who are actively starving to death food that is actively dangerous, that is expired, that could poison them. You are not only, you're not being complicit in genocide. At that point, you are actively taking part in it.
Indeed, they are. Now, ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our expose for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Expose. The truth is just a revelation away.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arabic English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in today's episode of Muslim Lady. Well, this is Asma, your host. Once more, I have the pleasure to be in this studio, and here with me, I have Sister Rehana. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to our dear listeners. I'm very happy to be here, and of course, Ramadan Kareem to all of my
yes, of course.
Muslim
Thank
friends
you for
all over the world.
Up. So that's very amazing. Ramadan Kareem to you and to everyone who's listening to us, and especially to the Muslim ladies. I think when the holy month of Ramadan comes, all the mothers and all the Muslim ladies are going to go through too much. Whatever they do is going to be doubled up. So before we get into our discussion, I just want you to introduce yourself very much briefly for those who still are not familiar with you.
I'm Rehana Paysapar, and I'm an Islamic researcher, especially on women's issues in today's age. And I am also a mother.
Ah, that's very amazing. So, Muslim ladies, we are going to continue with the subject of divorce. Actually, previously, we talked about the reasons and the factors that might lead a path to divorce, a couple life into divorce and separation. So what were the reasons? One of the very most important of them was the loss of attraction. Like, they come out of this honeymoon phase and they would lose that spark that you mentioned. Like, okay, we no longer have that thing that relates us to each other. Like, there's no more of attraction when we are together. I do not feel anything toward him. This was one of the reasons. Another one was the fact that they do not spend quality time with each other. They did not interact and communicate with each other perfectly. They did not devote special time for that. And the other factor was some sort of external factor, like one of the couples, one of the members in this holy institution of family gets to be attracted to somewhere else, like they would chase their happiness somewhere else, which is actually something that is that must be looked at from a sociological perspective. Like, we as members of society have responsibility toward each other. Like, when we say the importance of hijab is something that would help the family, we mean this exactly. So now, aside from all of these things that we mentioned as factors, now you tell us if there's any other factors that, of course, there are a list, a huge list of factors out there. But just since we have a limited time, let's see what's more to be added in order to get into the solution.
Thank you for that recap, Sister Asma. But before I move on to the next factor that is effective, I would like to mention that Islam has a high regard for the institution of marriage. It actually gives a lot of opportunities for a couple to become closer to one another through giving rewards. It gives rewards for various things that can help the couple have that attraction.
And strengthen their bond.
Yes, strengthen that attraction, strengthen their bond. And for instance, we can mention that Allah has set a reward for when a man and a woman, like a husband and a wife, I mean, look into each other's eyes lovingly. Even for that small, very small act, Allah has set a reward. And the reason for that, we must assume, is that how effective it can be in rekindling that spark and for maintaining that attraction.
Reawaken that spark.
Yes. And another thing is that there are rewards for when, for example, a wife creates a situation where the husband and wife can spend some quality time with each other. So as you might have experienced before, I mean, dear listeners have experienced before maybe, sometimes men are just not that attentive. They forget that they have to stop for a second, spend some quality time with the family. They just have so much on their mind. And I guess Allah has somehow not given the responsibility of it to women, but has understood that women have more of this power to create the situation.
Well, now here, just for the record, we have to mention something, but then let's go for a break and then we'll be back and I would bring that up. Welcome back. This is Muslim Ladies. Sister Rehane and I were talking about ladies, staff, but then we came to the issue of divorce, and I already gave you an introduction. Then Sister Rehane was just mentioning some ways, some solutions for how to reawaken that spark and how to regain that attention that we have for each other, as I mean in the institution of family and in marriage for couples. Women are more passionate, they're kinder, and this is pretty much clear.
And they think about these stuff more as
And they care about emotion. They are the faculty of emotion and feeling. And by the way, I'm not saying that they do not think. They have both and they can moderate. But then there comes this issue that we've been talking about many times in Muslim Lady. You're saying that men, when they come to home, they're not attentive because they're tired, because they have had enough in their plates, and that's very right. But then unfortunately, as a result of the problems of this today's world, let's say, a lot of women are spending a lot of their time outside the home, just like the man. So when they come home, they again are not attentive. They again wish someone else to take care of them. Like, you know what I mean? I mean, yes. They would feel like, okay, it's his responsibility. Like, it's not me, the only one who's responsible. Like, I have had enough just like him. Okay, but you are just breaking the cycle. You're just I don't know how to say it. You know, I do not say that women should not work or should not attend extra activities outside the home.
No,
but
of course not.
All what I mean is that when we change the directions, the natural direction and cycle of everything in this world, things are going to get ruined, like the relationship between
exactly.
family. Another important factor which is going to lead to divorce is the fact that neither of them, not men, nor the woman, are going to get enough of their relationship because they're tired.
Responsibilities of the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned it. But the thing is that I presumed a situation which is ideal in Islam.
Yeah, that's ideal of Islam. I understand.
Yes.
That's why I brought it up.
When, that is a very good
when
point.
The woman is actually doing her job and doing her responsibility as a mother and as a wife, though, she, I say it, we are not saying that women should not work, women should not have any extra activities outside the home. No. We just say that it's not women's responsibility to bring money.
Yes.
That's the thing that Islam says. Islam actually respects women more than just money maker sort of creatures. I usually call mothers as artists because a great
yes.
mother is going to paint some beautiful canvases of human beings and personalities.
We have a narration that says, "Al-mar'atu rayhana wa laysat biqahrimana." So I believe that this
and
word...
And what is the translation of it, just for those who uh-huh. do not know Arabic?
Yes, it means that women are like flowers. They aren't heroes. And what I believe the word hero entails is women having it all, doing everything, working outside the home, doing labor, that doing hard labor to earn money, and also having the responsibilities of the house, because we all know that the major responsibility of child rearing falls on the shoulders of women. I think that it's really important. That is another thing that about the basic principles of Islam when it comes to the family unit. So,
and of course, we have Lady Fatimatu Zahra as the role model. I mean, just look at her. Yes, she had some gatherings. She had meetings in which she would clarify religious stuff and philosophical issues to other women. But then she was not doing a lot of jobs outside the home. Like, she was the mother to kids whose destiny changed the destiny of human beings. But then she was this flower that you were just talking about.
Yeah, so it is important to understand and to really consider the responsibilities of a woman in the family. When a woman gets married, consequently means that she has accepted all of the responsibilities that comes along with marriage.
Exactly.
So having a job and earning money is not a part of those responsibilities. So it's not on the shoulders of the woman to earn the money. So this
and means... unfortunately, again, I have to interrupt you, but before I just point out what I'm going to say, let's go for a break and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back and thank you for staying with us, Muslim ladies. Yes, there was a point I just wanted to bring out. Just as you said, women are not meant to make money. I mean, the responsibility is not on their shoulders. It's the men who are meant to be the money makers and to provide the facilities for life. Unfortunately, there's this case in which I've heard about and I was so, I don't know, I was just shocked. Like the man who was searching for a woman to marry, one of his criterion was for the woman to be working. And then why, what
wow.
is his justification? Is the fact that, okay, life is difficult. Me alone am not going to be able to afford all the money is needed for a life.
Oh my God, that is so unattractive.
But see, just, I mean, like, just see what women have done to themselves. Like, you bring yourself into a position in which to be a working woman becomes a criterion for your decisions for life.
That is basically telling your wife that I want you to work and to earn money for us.
Like, I'm counting on you to afford money for me.
Oh, that is very...
And this very idea was something I have never heard about. Like, when I heard, I was just so shocked. But unfortunately, when I come to see reality in the world, I see that, yes, this has been one of the factors. Like, a woman who's working outside the home, like a girl who has been achieving a lot of things, like she can make a perfect amount of money, is more acceptable by other men. Why? Okay, think about it just.
Yeah, that is a result of men and women forgetting their responsibilities and
their roles.
Yes, and buying into these feminist movements that, when you think about it, actually benefit men rather than women.
Yeah, that's the point.
To be perfectly honest. So one of the important reasons that people mention, one of the common reasons that people mention when getting a divorce is lack of attraction and losing the spark. And that could be because of men and women forgetting their roles, their actual roles and responsibilities in a marriage, and creating these false goals and their own criteria and responsibilities that aren't even true.
And the traps of the slogans. A lot of movements are out there speaking of the right of women and this and that. All of these things would mislead men and women, even in their relationships as couples.
Yeah, so it is a important topic, and inshallah, we'll delve deeper into it into other episodes.
Exactly, yeah. So since it is a topic that has got a lot of other chains getting into it, like it's an interlaced issue, when you talk about divorce, a lot of factors come from different dimensions of individual and social life. So things are related to each other, and it gets into new roads and new paths. That's why sometimes we get to talk about other factors by detail. So thank you, Sister Rehane. And thank you, dear listeners. This was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and it comes fruitful. So thank you. Until another session, I leave you to God's never sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature. Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the pleasure to be at your service. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Mustafa. And assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum assalam.
So, as the ritual of this program goes, I would love you both to introduce yourself pretty briefly. Let's start with Sister Nahid.
Assalamu alaikum to you and your dear listeners. My name is Nahid. I'm an MA graduate of CFL, and I'm so honored to be with you and your listeners today.
Thank you very much for being here, and your brother Mustafa.
My name is Mustafa, and I'm studying here in the Hausa. I'm studying psychology here, and I'm originally from Pakistan, but I've lived in different countries.
So thank you very much, both of you, for coming here and for joining us in today's episode. So let's jump into it. I mean, the heart of the discussion for today's episode. Well, imagine a condition in which there's a snake, and then you've been bitten by that snake. So what would you do the next step? The snake has gone. Now you're bitten. Maybe the poison is running into your blood system. And then are you going to go and search for the snake and ask the snake, why have you just bitten me?
Yeah, obviously, either I'm going to probably die in the process, right, if I were to do that. You know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of a very similar sort of Zen tradition, a Japanese Zen tradition, where they talk about how there's two monks, and they're walking, and it's raining, and they come up to, like, a road crossing, and there's, like, a woman standing there. So she asks for help, right? She says, can you help me cross the street because it's full of water? And the first, one of the monks, he just picks up the woman and he carries her across to the other side. Then these two monks, they continue walking. So the other monk, he's really annoyed, right? So he asks him, like, what happened? He's like, we're monks. We're not supposed to, do that. So he says, look, I put her down, 5 minutes ago. Why are you still carrying her, right? So I think the idea is that you don't want to, carry negative emotions with you, right? I'm assuming that's one of the ideas that comes to my mind. There's definitely other things we can talk about, but that's one idea that comes to my mind.
Speaking of these situations, it's usually in our, instinct that sometimes we'd like to find the cause or the root of something that happens to us. But it's the maturity and our knowledge that decides here in this situation. Either we're going to react or we're going to still find information. As forgiveness, I guess sometimes even forgiveness plays a significant role here. That is the person going to forgive and just solve it within themselves? Mm-hmm. Or no, they're going to just go deep into the details and find a route that is most of the times useless and self-harming, there is no use in finding the roots of the instinct of another person that has caused too many problems for us.
Well, I should say that as human beings, it's not that easy to put it this way that, okay, we should just forget about it and things like that. Yes, we may forgive, but to forget, that's very difficult. So we technically might go for causes because that would give us a lot more of elaboration about ourselves. Like I ask myself, okay, I'm going for these causes because I want to know what's wrong with me.
But sometimes there is nothing wrong with us,
Another situation I think where this would actually apply is maybe, let's say, somebody who's done you wrong and now you need to, fight for your right.
Yeah.
Right? If somebody's, wronged me and I can seek justice, right? Then I would go after the snake and seek justice, Why would I let a wrongdoer just escape and get away? They should be brought to justice. They should be that oppression should be taken away from society, right?
Yeah, but sometimes the case is too clear that we know that it's in the other person's personality.
It depends on the situation then.
Yeah,
sure. Oh, yeah, we're getting somewhere nice. You're talking about the nature of human beings. Let's just go for a break and then we'll be back to see some more of details about what you mentioned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Yes, we just brought up a case and then we're just dissecting different parts of it. And since we are in Back to Reality, we have to figure out what the reality is all about. So for every single thing that we mention in here, there are different perspectives. Maybe you as listeners are going to get another dimension of what we're talking about. So these are just some triggers to make you think more about different occasions, like in our real everyday human interactions. So you mentioned human nature, and I guess you mean that, okay, I know that the nature of this person is a bitter nature, yeah. like they have got this personality that is unchangeable and it would affect other people.
Yes.
And now that it's like that, I have to let it go.
I have to forgive, you know. As recently I've been just reading some stories, and I've heard the story of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that in Surah Al-Araf, verse 199, it is mentioned, like, God is directly even telling his Prophet to enjoy forgiveness and just let go of the foolish from the people, turn away from the foolish and enjoy that forgiveness within yourself.
Yeah.
And that has really affected me. Like, since I read this, I recognize that even the Prophet, who has all the right to fight for the foolish actions of people, even mm-hmm. the people from his own time, he's been commanded to forgive and let go of the actions that are hurting him.
Well, now, as a person who listens to what you say, I would say that these things are easier said than done.
Yeah. Yeah,
like, but in a practical world of reality, when we're living with each other and we have interaction with normal, ordinary human beings, it's very difficult for me to be as kind as a prophet and then say, okay, this other person, this coworker of mine, this, I don't know, classmate of mine who's doing me wrong, I would forgive everything
yeah,
they do
totally
to me.
Yeah, I totally understand. It's so hard to act like him. But yeah. at least we can have him as the role model. Think of his stories deeply.
Exactly.
I was saying, you know, you'll find, like, sometimes normal, everyday-to-day people, they'll forgive their, you know, someone who's been murdered in their family. I don't know if you ever heard these kind of stories.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, in Islam, we are highly, highly recommended to forgive others. I should add the sort of the idea, although, is that if someone is, like, is causing harm to society, that's not necessarily a place where we should be forgiving them, right? Let's say somebody's yeah. like known for like stealing or committing fraud. You don't necessarily want to like...
Yeah, there are too many cases in which we are not even allowed to forgive.
Right, right. So it depends on the case. But mm-hmm. if it's like somebody who's individually maybe wronged me, somebody who said something wrong yeah. to me, if it's just something that's personal, then we definitely should be going towards the forgiveness side as much as we can. And we'll see that makes us better. Well, one thing I would say in the analogy that we're using where the snakes has bitten us, you know, we're saying that we may end up wasting a lot of our time on, like, other people that have maybe caused us harm. Like, I think my teacher says this one...
Like we might die in the process of searching for the reasons.
Well, he says, like, you know, like getting angry at somebody else because they've, let's say, insulted you or something is really like you... like drinking poison yourself, right?
Yeah.
This can also relate to like overthinking, right? Sometimes mm-hmm. you overthink about a situation too much. Whereas we're saying, look, let it go. Like, be easy. Like,
let the bygones be the bygones.
Yeah. Like, people are like this. Like, you know, we've probably caused other people harm in our lives, right? And they've forgiven us. So we should be just as kind to them, I mm-hmm. think, right? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I guess the first step can be to give ourselves some bit of time. Like reacting, and most of the times overreacting even worsens the problem. And sometimes looking at the issue from the both sides, like the person who has done the wrong and our own self, that we surely this way can judge better. We can think of both situations. And sometimes mm-hmm. even we can make ourselves accept the situation better and react better.
Yeah, now we had a professor of criticism, actually. We had criticism together. And then in the stories, you know how the characters work out. Like, there are some characters who would hurt the other people. And then, just as we were just criticizing and analyzing those characters, he came to mention something very nice. He said that when you are going to analyze people, try to put yourself in their shoes. Like, try to have some empathy. Like, there are some evil characters that you would feel even sympathy with these sort of characters. Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We're talking about how to let go, which is not a very easy task. But then we have to learn from the, just as you mentioned, from the Prophet, from the role models that we have in our Islamic heritage. And There are also other things that we could gain through practice in everyday life. Like if we start, I always think, what are the ways for me to stop overthinking? Because I guess the first step is when I come to digest things into detail. Like I come to bring each and every part out and think about them too much in an excessive way.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the way to stop overthinking is to really distract yourself. You know, we sometimes do this with kids, right?
Yeah.
When kids are like doing something wrong, we'll tell, like, we need to distract them, right? My teacher was saying that his daughter died and his niece died during COVID.
Oh.
And that had a really, really huge like impact on him, right?
Yes.
On an emotional level. And he's a therapist himself, but he said the way he would stop himself from like overthinking about the sadness and the grief, like he would just go get groceries. He would go water the garden, right?
Yeah.
He would go play with kids. So that's one technique I think you can use. By the way, one thing I wanted to mention before that you mentioned the point about empathy. So when we talk about, you know, doing therapy of others, you know, when you have someone who comes to you for therapy, the key technique to get them to sort of open up and to like, you know, trust you and to tell you their problems, you must empathize with them,
mm-hmm.
right? And I asked my teacher, what if like, you know, somebody comes and tells you something really extreme? Because people do really extreme things, right?
Exactly.
Sometimes they're really disgusting or they're really horrifying.
Yeah.
He said that, you know, that person who's asking me for help, I see that they're, you know, they're burning on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. They need, they're like under stress. So my job is to feel that stress and their pain, and that way I can then help cure them. I think sometimes that's why some people harm us. Like they're sick or they need help.
Exactly. It's their shout for help.
And like we've given examples of the Prophet, he would many times, you know, you're told be nice to someone who harms you, right? At times, because that helps them become better.
I guess our brain, human brain, loves to think a lot, loves to find different aspects, think about it, and sometimes bother us. And I guess the intentional stop that we can have on our brain and on our thinking can really help. When we intentionally stop overthinking, mm-hmm. Little by little, this will be our habit of not bothering
yeah.
ourselves with
it's
something
like
that is not...
It's like habit formation. You're
exactly,
helping
it's
your
not
brain
ideal.
To go for habit formation.
Yeah.
Which, again, needs a lot of practice.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So in the case of the snake that we brought up at the very beginning of this episode, I guess we should not go and search for the snake because we might die in the process. So we just have to deal with the poison that has been inside of us.
But sometimes it applies to religious issues. Sometimes people ask, like, you know, 1,000 questions about something where we may not necessarily have answers for, right?
Exactly.
You sometimes have to accept reality, right? This is mm-hmm. this is the reality.
And I'm sure if we search and search and dig deeper, we might have some other dimensions and perspectives toward that analogy mentioned at the very beginning of today's episode. So thank you, brother, and thank you, sister, for your cooperation. And thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another session. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمار عزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي التي أما رايزك لتصي دليلتك وانسك.
Discovering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? There is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death or where did they go. So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
Cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life is, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity. And death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from. And that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, a man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. Oh man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the Day of Judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is no, and there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا نُزُلًا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ.
Death is an astonishing pass through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body, and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death, or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume, and secondly,
we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ, and they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul